Welcome back, dear listeners. It's an honor to have you with us. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. So we're talking about the dialogues of the Master of Martyrs, Imam al-Hussein, alayhi salam. We find that when addressing Muslim ibn Awsajja, in the dialogues of Imam al-Hussein, alayhi salam, we find a dialogue that His Eminence had with Muslim ibn Awsajja. In this dialogue that Imam al-Hussein, alayhi salam, had with Muslim ibn Awsajja, he brought up a verse of the Holy Quran upon the martyrdom of Muslim ibn Awsajja. And so as Muslim ibn Awsajja was breathing his last breaths upon this earth, and he was being granted the glorious state of martyrdom, Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam said to him, in the words of the Holy Quran, some of them fulfilled their vows, and some still await, and have not changed the least. And so, dear friends, from this dialogue of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam with one of his loyal and faithful companions, Muslim ibn Awsajja, we find that there are vows that we have all taken in our own lives. We have decided to walk the path of Islam, the path which leads to ultimate perfection, both in this world and the next. And so, based upon this vow that we have made with the Almighty Allah, we must fulfill this vow throughout the entirety of our lives. Yes, difficulties may come, trials and tribulations may come. We will face good times and we will face bad times. But throughout these times, that which is important is that we always remain steadfast on our vows, that we will continue to walk the path of Islam. And yes, one day or the other, we will have to most surely leave this world. And along with leaving this world, we will also end up leaving everything that we have materially collected in this world. And so as we fulfill this vow of ours, and we fulfill this oath of being righteous Muslims, we must also get rid of the materialistic burdens that are shackling us down in this materialistic realm. Dear friends, it is not easy to be able to fulfill a vow and an oath throughout the entirety of one's life, but with the help of the Almighty Allah, and by taking Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam as an intermediary and a wasila for us, by the grace and blessings of the Almighty Allah, we will be able to fulfill our vows to remain determined and steadfast upon the path of Islam. And, God willing, we too will meet our Maker while in the hands and the arms of the Imam of our time. This is Dialogue, Imam al-Hussein, alayhi salam. As-salamu alayka ya أبا عبد الله. Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, for listening to this episode of the program Dialogue. We hope that you remain under the auspicious grace of Imam Hussein today and always. عليك
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Money in exchange for stopping Tunisians from leaving the country. That's the core of the Memorandum of Understanding sealed in Tunis on Sunday by the outgoing Dutch Prime Minister Mark Rutte and the Italian Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni, under the supervision of the European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen. Actually, the memorandum is rather vague on financial figures. Some media have reported that the deal is worth 1 billion euros. Others say that the figures stipulated could change according to developments on the ground. What has emerged so far is that the EU intends to provide 105 million euros to Tunis to curb irregular migration. According to the European Coast Guard agency Frontex, there were more than 100,000 illegal border crossings through the central Mediterranean last year, a 50% rise compared to 2021, with Italy struggling to cope with this surge in arrivals.
We want real equality and do not want sympathy without respect. Today we need a collective agreement on inhuman migration and on the displacement processes behind which criminal networks hide. The world has been divided in two, half for the rich and half for the poor. It is no longer possible for this monetary system to continue in the same form and content. This global monetary system creates darkness wherever it wants.
Tunisia, together with Libya, is considered one of the main gateways for asylum seekers who wish to reach European shores. The country has often been described by Western media as being in a state of financial malaise following the COVID-19 pandemic, rising inflation, high unemployment, and a worldwide swell in commodity prices.
According to some EU leaders, Brussels should make the Cash for Migrant Control Accord with Tunisia a model for similar deals with other countries. The EU has reportedly been in talks with Egypt on a similar agreement.
The partnership with Tunisia has to be considered as a model for building new relations with North African neighbors. All these, a few months ago, would have been unthinkable.
The EU is also willing to put on the table a substantial package of macro-financial assistance to, quote, support Tunisia's fragile economy and prevent the situation from spiraling out of control. Tunisian President Saied has repeatedly rejected what he calls diktats of the international financial institutions, which have tried to persuade Tunisia to remove state subsidies on basic goods, such as fuel and bread. Saied has said these measures will only lead to more poverty and are unacceptable. Max Civili, Rome.
More than 500 Iranian enterprises and companies gathered to take part in an award ceremony that is expected to up their games and also allow them to gain a foothold in the OIC economy. Nearly 150 of them passed the quality control test to acquire four-star status, the highest defined by the Standard and Metrology Institute of Islamic Countries, also referred to as SMIC.
This award, or better said, the four-star certificate, represents the highest standard of Iranian products, according to OIC member states. It will allow our companies to export their goods and services to OIC member states and also improve market conditions and competitiveness.
The standard, in terms of bring the specification of the products. If you know the, what is the products, what ingredients, what the specification of the products, you can easily trade. And this brings also international recognition of the products, and free trade will bring the remove the barriers.
The companies that were awarded the certificate and acquired the four-star status couldn't agree more.
I believe that the true award is the trust that our customers have in our products. The fact that they believe our name stands for high-quality products, for me, is more valuable than any award or certificate.
The companies that are active in food industries definitely require international standards, and for OIC member states, the halal standard is of great importance. We tried very hard to reach this level and gain the 4 stars and the halal certificate.
The Standards and Metrology Institute of Islamic Countries is the most important organization in compiling standards in the fields of food, health, and tourism management systems accepted by 57 member states of the Organization of Islamic Cooperation. The Islamic Republic of Iran is one of the most active members of the Technical Committee of SMIC. As an institute developing the necessary mechanisms in the OIC, the Standards and Metrology Institute of Islamic Countries is paving the way for member states to recognize each other's standard certificates. This will in turn help to boost trade. Gisumi Shahmadi, Tehran.
As the U.S. is sending cluster bombs to Ukraine, the deadly legacy of these destructive U.S. weapons continues to take its toll on civilians in other countries, including Afghanistan. According to Human Rights Watch, the U.S. dropped more than 1,200 cluster bombs containing tens of thousands of bombless in Afghanistan in the first 3 years of its invasion of the country. As a result, hundreds of Afghan people were killed, wounded, or maimed forever.
It was 10 p.m. when bombardment started on our house. I was targeted with an American bomb while fleeing the bombardment. I lost my feet and my hand was injured. Since then, I have been living a terrible life.
The Taliban's official for martyrs and disabled affairs also says the U.S. war on Afghanistan has created many victims, especially from cluster bombs.
Most martyrs, disabled and maimed people registered by our administration or harmed by the U.S. indiscriminate strikes and cluster bombs. The U.S. used to claim they were targeting Taliban fighters, but their destructive war machines destroyed an entire village and left no civilian unharmed.
Military experts have warned that unexploded cluster bombs across Afghanistan are still posing a serious threat to the lives of innocent people, including school children, shepherds, and farmers.
War was ongoing in all 34 provinces of Afghanistan. Cluster bombs were dropped by NATO and American forces in most places. I'm sure that they're not cleared yet, especially in the outskirts of the cities, mountainous in conflict areas. They pose a serious threat to civilians there. International bodies and NGOs as well as the Taliban should solve the problem as soon as possible.
Afghan people urge the international community to prevent the use of cluster bombs globally and hold the U.S. accountable for their war crimes in Afghanistan. The U.S. left Afghanistan 2 years ago, but its unexploded bombs are still here, posing threat to the lives of innocent people. Afghans are calling for justice and support from the international community. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Is GDP a real indicator of economic growth of a given nation? Many economists agree that although the measure is a rough and ready instrument to assess the size of economy of a given country, it is not designed to estimate welfare or the well-being of its citizens. However, most governments resort to broadcasting their growing GDP to reassure domestic and international markets. Italy's current executive makes no exception. Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni has, on several occasions, stressed that GDP growth is a measure of success for her predecessor Mario Draghi and her government.
Our capacity for post-pandemic recovery is therefore all to see. Today, the Italian economy is growing beyond expectations, with an upward forecast estimate of GDP of more than 1.2% in 2023.
Based on the final data for 2022, I'm using the 2023 projections from the latest OECD Economic Outlook, Italy is expected to achieve the strongest economic growth among G7 countries in the 2023 period, with a 5% increase in GDP over 2 years. The situation on the ground is very much different. Inflation in Italy has risen remarkably from mid-2021, passing the 12% mark last year. Over one in four people in the country were at risk of poverty or social exclusion in 2022, according to a latest report by the National Bureau of Statistics, Istat. Furthermore, just under 25% of Italians between the ages of 15 and 29 are at risk of becoming poor, compared to an EU average of around 20%.
As for Italy's crisis, wealth distribution in the country has never been so uneven, with an increasing number of workers practically falling into a state of slavery. The decision by the ECB to raise interest rates to counter high inflation has only aggravated the situation. This way, the payments on variable-rate mortgages have practically doubled for a large number of Italian households.
Also, data by charity Oxfam shows the concentration of wealth in Italy has considerably increased by the end of 2021. The wealth of the richest 5% of Italians, owner of over 40% of national wealth, was higher than the stock of wealth held by the poorest 80%. The picture is the same across the whole of Europe, too. Data from the European Statistical Agency Eurostat shows the gulf between rich and the poor has become tragically more pronounced, also in the old continent, over the past years. Max Civili, Rome.
Iraqi Prime Minister Mohammed al-Sudani has arrived in Damascus, where he was received in an official welcoming ceremony by Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. The two leaders held talks discussing bilateral relations and means of enhancing them, especially in trade exchange, transport and industry, as well as in the political field and joint efforts in fighting terror and securing their shared 600-kilometer border from security threats. Assad said this visit is an opportunity to establish institutional relations and boost bilateral cooperation. The Iraqi top official said the Iraqi people are proud of Syrians' steadfastness. The two sides held a press conference underlining the importance of collaboration to address joint challenges such as terror, drug smuggling, and water shortages.
There are challenges we face directly, mainly terrorism and cooperation in countering it. Terrorism is active due to Western support, using it as a tool to target countries adhering to its independence and national interests. Some regional countries also supported terrorism. The biggest challenge is the Syrian and Iraqi people being deprived of their share of the Euphrates water, which results in thirst, hunger, and illnesses. We also have challenges on drugs, which can destroy societies.
Assad noted that economic ties will be the focus of future discussions with the aim of overcoming the economic siege on Syria. He praised Iraq for its years-long support for Syria during the war. Al-Sudani reiterated his country's support for Syria's unity, referring to the necessity of solving the refugee situation.
Iraq's support for Syria's sovereignty and the government's control of all its territories is a matter of interest to Iraqi national security. The Syrian and Iraqi blood shed together portrays the clearest images of relations between both countries. The biggest joint challenges today are security and economy. We need more coordination. Today, we are creating mechanisms for such coordination.
Al-Sudani said Syria cannot be left alone in facing difficulties and called for lifting the unjust Western sanctions on the Arab country. He denounced the Israeli occupation of Arab lands as well as the regime's aggressions on Syria and Lebanon. The Iraqi official is accompanied by ministers of foreign affairs and trade as well as the deputy chief of joint operations in Iraq. The Iraqi Prime Minister's visit comes at a crucial time in which both countries are in a desperate need for increasing economic cooperation to overcome difficulties resulting from wars. Both states have for long suffered from Daesh terrorism, and high-level talks can strengthen joint efforts for countering terror. Muhammad Ali, Damascus.
On Thursday, tens of thousands of rail workers in Italy staged a day-long walkout over pay and safety at work, hampering public transportation services and tourists' access to their destinations. The strike action, called by the three largest trade unions, CGL, CISL and WIL, caused cancellations and delays to national and regional trains at the peak of the country's booming high tourist season. Italy, like much of Europe, is suffering from high inflation and stagnant economic growth, and unions are protesting against low wages, especially in relation to the ongoing increase in the cost of living.
Today's action revolves around two issues. We demand an adjustment of the collective pay agreements for our sector and more hiring to ease pressure on employees and their unsustainable workloads. Furthermore, more investments on railway maintenance are needed. Last-minute negotiations with the Transport Ministry failed on Tuesday. The government showed up too late.
Also, air transport workers are set to down tools on Saturday despite Transport Minister Matteo Salvini's attempts to persuade unions to call off the strikes. This new industrial action, the latest in a long line of transport strikes, is widely expected to be more disruptive than most, which are generally only backed by one or two major unions. Commuters are once again facing delays and cancellations. They are saying they are at the end of their rope.
Disruptions keep affecting us. It's not just about tourists. Commuters are those who are bearing the brunt for the mismanagement of our public transport system. This way, they force people to resort to their cars.
Workers' wages in Italy are excessively low. I understand those who are staging the strike. As a result, commuters are left to face the music.
About 90% of rail transport sector workers joined the strike called by CGL, CISL and WIL unions. Even high-speed lines that are usually guaranteed during Italy's frequent work stoppages were affected. Max Civili, Rome.
A familiar sight as the summer of strikes and disruptions in England rolls on. While some health workers have settled, junior doctors, who form 40% of the workforce in the National Health Service here, are still locked in a bitter war of words with the government. They say the request of a 35% pay rise is an opening offer and accuse the government of negotiating in bad faith. And while the deadlock continues, it's the patients who are paying the price, as hundreds of thousands of appointments and operations are postponed, despite Prime Minister Rishi Sunak setting cutting the NHS waiting list, now at more than 7 million, as a top priority.
The government argues that any pay rises funded through borrowing for these junior doctors or others in the public sector risk fueling the inflation that's highest among the G7 advanced economies. But not everyone agrees with that.
The cause of inflation is not the workers asking for wage rises. It's the printing of money. You see, central banks want to blame everybody but themselves. They printed the money. The US did it, the UK did it, the Europeans did it.
As the strike got underway, an announcement by the Prime Minister saying his government's offer for pay rises was the last such offer and that there would be no more negotiations with the unions. But with the tens of thousands of nurses and doctors having quit last year, the strikers say the pay rises are needed to keep them in the profession.
People are leaving the profession and we're losing staff. They're going across to Australia, New Zealand, America to get paid more money. But also within the UK, they're taking on more private work, equivalent private work.
This month, we'll also see disruption on the railways as an overtime ban for train drivers comes into force and as staff walk off altogether yet again. For the time being, disputes dragging on, plenty of problems for the government, few simple solutions. Said Burza, London.
a common wound among the Iranian and Japanese nation. Following the bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, Sardash became the third city to endure an attack by a weapon of mass destruction. Sardash, the first city to suffer a chemical attack, hosted a Japanese diplomatic delegation to commemorate the victims of this assault. According to Shiva, the wife of one of the victims of Sardash, her husband is still suffering from the consequences of the attack that occurred 36 years ago.
Because of the sanctions, I can't get the appropriate medicine for my husband. He has been suffering from chemo for a long time.
36 years ago, Western countries including the United States, England, and Germany provided Iraqi dictator Saddam with chemical weapons which he used on Iranian people. This action has not been condemned by any human rights body in the world. Mr. Murakami from the Japanese delegation emphasized the importance of telling the world about the crimes that took place in Sardash, saying this was the reason for their visit to the town.
I think it is important for the world to get to know about what happened in Sardash some 30, 40 years ago. So I think it's very important for me to really come visit this place.
The international community has turned a blind eye on this brutal chemical attack in the last 36 years. We can hope such meetings and gatherings can pave the way to raise the voice of the victims of this brutal attack. Farzana Shirin, Sardash.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant factor.
Imamat yek asl zinde ast dar tarikh Islam.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. Very welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali. Stay tuned. May Allah bless the soul of the late Ayatollah Hasta'i, one of the greatest ulama of Tehran. He was a great mujtahid and a professional lecturer, especially during the month of Muharram. He narrates that once, when approaching the month of Muharram, I asked Allah and Hazrat Fatima al-Zahra to give him a clue which majlis of Imam al-Hussein to attend. In a dream, she saw Lady Fatima, and Hazrat Fatima told him to go to a poor and needy neighborhood in suburban Tehran and give a speech over there. ¶¶
شما مجلس روزه داری؟ اشاره کرد یه کوچه بن‌بست کوچیکی بود.
The late Ayatollah went there and asked a lady for the house which holds majlis for Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. The lady pointed out to a dead-end lane in which there was a house with the sunstruck flag of Abu Abdullah. There were not many listeners in that majlis, but since it was a clue from Lady Fatima, the Ayatollah gave lecture for 10 days and nights of Muharram without receiving money. This story shows that holding a majlis for Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam can be done in the simplest form and without expensive food. This also shows that we, as lecturers for Muharram, must be sincere in our speech and action for Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. Thank you very much, dear listeners of Arab English Radio Call of Islam Page, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali. To find out more about this program, log on to our website parstoday.ir Call of Islam Page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Attacks and acts of terrorism against Palestinian journalists by the Zionist regime forces and Zionist settlers have seen a terrible rise across the occupied West Bank, including Al-Quds, recently. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Middle East Eye wrote in this regard, "The life of a local journalist in Britain is comparatively simple. Weddings, funerals, a spot of council corruption and the local football team. Less so in Nablus, though Nasser Ishtaye has covered plenty of funerals. The brutal circumstances of the occupation dictate that he is a war photographer. A job can be his last. As the man on the spot, he spends his life covering the clashes that are a constant factor in this beautiful and ancient city of 120,000 people in the northern West Bank. Since starting work 3 decades ago, Ishtaye says he has been shot 11 times by Zionist regime forces. 18 months ago, he was taking photographs in a nearby village when a Zionist troop fired at him from 6 meters. There seemed to be no tension, and he was not wearing a helmet. The rubber-tipped bullet grazed his skull, and he has the scar, a dull orange welt, to prove it. The Zionist regime troop aimed at his head, but at the last moment, Nasser looked behind him at some children. He believes that the backward glance may have saved his life. Ishtaya says he did not bother to report the incident because he had complained dozens of times about other episodes, and nothing had ever been done. He says the blame always falls on the journalist, not on the Zionist regime forces. Last month, both Reporters Without Borders, RSF, and the International Federation of Journalists condemned a culture of impunity within the Zionist regime's security forces. The most painful wound came, Ishtaya says, when he was shot in the foot. Once two rubber bullets struck him from behind. He recalls, "I had to sleep on my stomach for a month with an ice pack on my arse. If they want to attack journalists," continues Ishtaya, "they sometimes shoot at walls or at holes, so we get hit by the ricochet." Besides bullet wounds, Ishtaya says he has been jailed countless times, often had his camera smashed, and frequently been assaulted by Zionist settlers. In 2004, when then Prime Minister Ariel Sharon ordered the removal of settlements near Nablus, settlers threw Ishtaya down a well and left him for dead. By then, he was in a coma and widely reported to be dead. When he meets troops, they ask him, "You are still alive?" In return, he berates them at checkpoints. When reporters met for dinner at a Nablus restaurant, he'd come straight from covering a settler incursion in the village of Tormoyosaya, 15 kilometers south of Nablus. 30 houses were burnt, 60 cars destroyed. The IDF was protecting the settlers. One man, Omar Hesham Jabra, was fatally shot by Zionist settlers. Many residents of the village have close links to the United States, and Jabra's wife and children were American citizens. Ishtaya says that even though he and media colleagues all had been carrying press accreditation, the settlers attacked them as well. But not before he'd got the pictures he needed. Ishtaya's work has made him one of the most respected war photographers in the world. Many of his pictures have been across the front pages of the world press. Some, such as his extraordinary photograph of a young girl creeping under the barrel of an Israeli regime tank on her way to school in Nablus in 2003, have become iconic images. In his remarkable career, which included 25 years at the news agency, he has chronicled more than three decades of the Zionist regime occupation. Now freelance, Ishtaya, 51, looks older than his years. He's a small man with a weathered face and an engaging smile. Local reporters confirm that Ishtaya is often cheerful, but he says that when he sleeps, he's tormented by nightmare. He says, "All the time I am dreaming that a Zionist troop is going to shoot me." At such moments, he says, "I think of making photographs of everyday life." But with the Zionist regime attacks recently, there is little chance of a cheerful day today. With the Zionist regime security forces in recent weeks carrying out a succession of brutal raids in the West Bank, and settler attacks against Palestinians also on the rise. Ishtaya brought his 17-year-old son Mohammed with him to dinner. He says, "It's very worrying." Mohammed shrugs his shoulders and says, "But it's what he does." Many of Ishtaya's best friends have been killed. Tariq Ayub and Mazen Dana, both killed in Iraq. He adds, Nazih Darwaze, shot in the head by Zionist regime forces during the Second Intifada in Nablus. And Shirin Abu Aqile, killed by an Israeli regime sniper in Jenin last year. He says he was one of the last people to speak to Abu Aqile before her death. She rang him as he drove from Nablus to join her in Jenin camp. For years, they had covered the Second Intifada from Nablus, staying in the same hotel in those desperate times. She worked in all of Palestine, in every province, city and village. Everyone loved her, he says. Meanwhile, the website of New Arab reported the Zionist regime settlers shot at journalists and homes and attacked an ambulance recently amid a period of heightened violence against Palestinians in the occupied West Bank. Zionist settlers stormed the Palestinian village of Safa near Ramallah, shooting at homes, said local mayor Marwan Sabah. A horse was killed and some homes partly caught alight. It was cited as saying by the official Palestinian news agency Wafa. An ambulance and other vehicles were damaged with a paramedic shot and mightily wounded while transporting someone to a hospital. Wafa said the ambulance was shot. There were reportedly dozens of settlers who stormed Safa. The Palestinian Health Ministry issued a statement on the messaging app, saying an ambulance with a patient on board had been attacked near Safa. Health Minister Mai Kala, who condemned the attack, said settlers threw stones at the vehicle, with the driver left injured. The patient was not hurt, she said, urging the international community to protect medical staff and Palestinians from ongoing Zionist settler terrorism.
Sheikh Baqir Sharif Al-Qarashi decides to compile...
So we can consider Sayyid Hadi Khosrow Shahi...
Shahid Muhammad Baqir al-Sadr.
He was born in Kadhimiya.
The first and the most important thing that we can learn from Allama Tabatabai is his great effort.
In this regard, I should like to say that one of the great benefits of the late Ayatollah Sayyid Mahmoud Shahrudi was...
When we look at the works of late Rawzati, we see...
There is a famous sentence from Mirza Khalil Qamari that he says in Farsi, Tuhid kalame baraye kalame tuhid.
Be more familiar with outstanding Shia figures in the teacher.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. Very welcome to another episode of the program, The Teacher, an introduction into the thoughts and works of the most prominent Sahabi or the companions of Prophet Muhammad and the Shiite infallible Imams. I am Ata, the host of this program. Sheikh Rouhani and Sheikh Fadai are two guest speakers for today's discussion. Sheikh Fadai, salamu alaikum.
Salamu alaikum.
And Sheikh Rouhani, salamu alaikum to
you.
Today we want to talk about a prominent Sahabi of Prophet Muhammad and the Shiite infallible Imams, Jabir ibn Abdullah Ansari. His fruitful life starting from the time of Prophet Muhammad, Imam Ali alayhi salam, up to Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam, is really outstanding and gives us so many historical lessons regarding the life of the Shiite infallible Imams. He is considered to be among the most authentic Sahabi of Prophet Muhammad and the Shiite infallible Imams. Shaykh Rouhani, let's start with you, brother. Give us some details about the early life and biography of Jabir ibn Abdullah Ansari.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Jabir ibn Abdullah Ansari was one of the great companions of the Holy Prophet Sallallahu Alaihi wa alayhi wa sallam. He narrated lots of narrations from the Holy Prophet. Among them, the most important one is Hadith al-Lawh, in which the names of the A'imma alayhi salatu wasalam mentioned.
Oh, he's a ravi of this hadith?
Yeah, the names were mentioned, and also by this hadith, nowadays the Shia Muslims prove the, authenticity and truthfulness of the imamat of Ahlul Bayt alayhi salatu wasalam, because this hadith is the most authentic and trustable hadith.
Okay.
So, and also Hadith Ghadir, also he was among the narrators of Hadith Ghadir, Hadith al-Thaqalain, Hadith Madinatul Ilm or Shahr al-Ilm.
Oh.
So these are the very nice and meaningful hadiths which were narrated by Jabir ibn Abdullah Ansari. Of course, he was from Medina, and then actually he went to Mecca as well. And in the early years of Islam, he accepted Islam, and also it says that at the time of the Holy Prophet, his father also had a very great role in the defending Islam and, protecting the Holy Prophet in different battles. And it is said that his father also was martyred in one of the ghazawat of the Holy Prophet Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam. That's why his father had also a great role in the history of Islam. And he himself had also a very great role at the time of the Prophet, particularly after the time of the Prophet, at the time of the A'imma alayhim salatu wasalam, as he is considered among the companions of the Imam Amir al-Mu'minin Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, Imam al-Hassan alayhi salatu wasalam, Imam Hussein, and Imam Sajjad, and Imam al-Baqir, five imams.
Okay.
He is among the companions of these five imams of Ahlul Bayt alayhim salatu wasalam.
That's right.
And he narrated one of the very beautiful hadiths from the Holy Prophet Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam, which include the salam of the Holy Prophet to Imam al-Baqir alayhi salatu wasalam. He was alive till the time of Imam al-Baqir, and he visited Imam al-Baqir and conveyed this message of the Holy Prophet Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam, because the Prophet Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam told him that you will see my grandson, whose name is by like my name, Muhammad.
Yes.
And please tell him my salam.
That's
and
right.
He visited Imam al-Baqir and conveyed this message to Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salatu wasalam.
Very good, very nice. Really outstanding hadith you mentioned, Hadith al-Qadir, Saqlain, Shahrul Ilm, or we can say Madinatul Ilm. These are the pillars of ahadith of the Shiite beliefs. Hadith al-Lawh by Hazrat Fatima al-Zahra from the tongue of Prophet Muhammad about the names of infallible imams, which shows the authenticity of the Shiite imams with the names mentioned. Okay, Shaykh Fadai, what other information do we have about his faithfulness to the infallible imams? I mean, Imam Ali, Imam Hassan, Imam al-Hussein, Imam Sajjad, and Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam.
Besides his scholarly position, that our brother mentioned that he was a faqih and a ravi, we can see his position in jihad. He was one of the mujahids. As it is recorded in our history, he participated in most of the wars of Prophet, in Ghazawat and Sariyat. It is mentioned that in 27 Ghazwa, he participated, and in 19 Sariyah.
Yes.
And after that, even in the time of Imam Ali alayhi salam, he participated in all of the wars that Imam Ali had with his enemies. And there was a group called Shurtatul Khamis.
Yes.
They were, we can call guards, special guards of Imam Ali. They participated in all the wars, and along with defending Imam Ali, not just in the wars, even when he was not in war, because always enemies wanted to kill Imam Ali, they were special guards of Imam Ali, and they promised to support Imam Ali up to their death. So Shortatul Khamis was a famous group, and Jaber was one of the members of Shortatul Khamis, and always they defend Imam Ali. So in the time of Prophet, in the time of Imam Ali, he was Mujahid. He spent most of his life in the battlefield.
Yes.
So it doesn't mean that he just sit in the house and teaching people. Yes.
Yes.
He had a lot of books. He narrated a lot of hadith. And even in Masjid al-Nabi,
yes.
There was a class that always he was there and teach people and teach hadith and yes. narration to people. And a lot of tabi'i narrated their hadith from Jaber. So Jaber is one of the scholarly figures that is accepted by both denominations.
That's right.
Shia and Sunni. Even okay. Sunni brothers, they accept Jaber. So he was a faqih, a ravi, and mujahid, all of them in the same time. So this is a very good example. And
even they said there is a sahifa, or a scroll of, we can say, a collection of the papers attributed to him called Sahifa to Jaber about the ahadith, isn't it?
Yes.
There is, yeah.
Yeah, there is. Well, one volume of this book there, they say this is kept in the Library of Suleymaniye in Istanbul, which is attributed to him showing his mastery over hadith studies.
Because he had a lot of hadith from yes. Prophet and Imam,
yes.
he was titled Hafiz al-Sunnah or Muqsir al-Hadith. It means
yes.
that he narrated yes. a lot of hadith yes. from Prophet and Imams.
Yes.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir. La ilaha illallah.
La ilaha illallah.
Sheikh Rouhani, Jaber's name is somehow related to the story of Ashura, Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, especially the Arba'in procession that are held today in the world. You know, here and there in the Shiite literature, you can find the name of Jaber ibn Abdullah Ansari very much linked to Arba'in or Arba'in procession. How is it?
Yes, the role of Jaber in the event of Arba'in is very much significant because you can say he was like founder of this, let's say, Ziyarah of Arba'in. Because at the time of Ashura, he was living in Medina. He was an old man at that time. He was not able at that time to attend, for example, the battlefields or go to fight. That's why when he heard the martyrdom of Imam Hussein, the news is about Karbala, he went by Atiyah, who was one of his servants, it seems.
Atiyah Ofi.
Ofi, of course, yes. Yeah. He went to Karbala to pay ziyarah of Imam al-Hussein alayhi wasalam. When he reached the Frat River, he took a bath. And
yes.
then actually by the very clean and purified kind of body, he approached the tomb of Imam Hussein alayhi salatu wassalam. Since he lost his sight, he couldn't see the things.
Yes.
That's why Atiyah helped him. And when he reached the tomb of Imam Hussein alayhi salatu wassalam, Atiyah put his hand on the grave of Abu Abdullah al-Hussein alayhi salatu wassalam. It is narrated that at this time, Jaber ibn Abdullah Ansari lost his conscience and fainted.
Yes.
And that is why called Imam Hussein this way three times, that Ya Hussein, Habibun, la yujibu habibah. It means that, O Hussein, the one whom I love, he should not respond, the lover or the one who loved Imam Hussein alayhi salatu wassalam. By this kind of sentences, he started Ziyarah of Abu Abdullah al-Hussein alayhi salatu wassalam, which is now known as Ziyarah of Arba'in. You see every year millions of people gather in Karbala and commemorate this event. And
this is just 40 days after the martyrdom of Imam al-Hussein.
40 days after the martyrdom of Abu Abdullah al-Hussein alayhi salatu wassalam.
That's all right. And as I said, in today's world, especially in the recent years, Arba'in procession, Arba'in walk, is among the main signs, we can say, of the ardent faithful followers of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. And not only Muslims, non-Muslims also take part in this, we can say, procession towards Karbala on the day of Arba'in. Okay, Sheikh Fadai, anything missed? We said that the his talk and dialogue with Imam al-Baghir alayhi salam was also famous, the salam that was sent to him.
You know, in the time of Prophet, he was one of the companions of Prophet and one of the trusted people around Prophet. Because Prophet loved him much, once he was talking with Jabir, and he said to Jabir, "You will have a long life until the time that one of my grandchildren called Muhammad, like me, you will visit him," which is the fifth Imam of Shia. "You will visit him, and at that time, you send my salam to my grandchild, Imam Baghir." And this is narrated that all the time he went to Masjid al-Nabi and called Ya Baghir al-Ulum. It means he was waiting for that time to visit Imam Baghir. So, and this happened in the time of Imam Baghir. Of course, in the time of Imam Baghir, he was not alive. Yes. But he visited Imam Baghir and he sent the salam of Prophet to Imam Baghir. And there is a point about Jabir. It is good to mention that maybe some people ask that why didn't Jabir participate in the battle of Ashura? As my Karbala, brother mentioned, he was old, but we can say that we have some other old people in Ashura, like Habib. But the main reason was that he was blind at that time. And in our fiqh, we have that wala ala al-a'ma harajun.
Yes.
So he was excused from jihad.
Yes.
So the point is that, you know, we when we love Ahlul Bayt, we know our duty. If we are able to go to battlefield, we go. Like Jabir, as I told you, he participated in the most of the wars in the time of Prophet, in the time of Imam Ali.
Against the Kuffar and Mushrikeen, that's
yes,
right.
But in the time of Imam Hussein, if he was able, surely he would do that.
Okay.
He was not able because he was blind. But but even at that time, he showed his love. How? By having a long journey from Medina to Karbala just to visit. You know, he could just send a salam from Medina to Imam Hussein. He didn't do that. Yes. He was an old man. He was blind. And the journey at that time was so hard.
So difficult.
He accepted that difficulty and went to the tomb of Imam Hussein and fainted on the grave. You know, this is a lesson.
Yes.
We should do whatever we can in order to show our real love, as Jabir did and showed us.
And compared to today's world, there are so many mockups or stations on the way to Karbala. It is really easier for the people nowadays to get into the city of Karbala, pay a visit to the holy shrine of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam on the day of Arba'in, also during the month of
Muharram. And we can say we owe that to Jabir somehow.
Yes, that's right. This tradition and this custom is owed to Jabir ibn Abdullah Ansari. Thank you very much, Sheikh Fadai and Sheikh Rouhani, for a nice elaboration regarding the life of Jabir ibn Abdullah Ansari. And thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program, The Teacher. For more information, visit our website on parstoday.ir, Call of Islam page. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.